And I have to say, I was a little apprehensive teaching Sunday morning's class, having never taught an adult class, but I'm assuming there were some people here who were just as apprehensive as me. I see we have some back in the audience this evening who fled town Sunday. We had several who left town, some left the state, so we're glad to have them back. All right. So tonight we're going to study, or we'll be discussing our introduction. We'll be discussing attestation, authorship, where the Second Corinthian letter was written, who was it written to, when it was written, why, those sort of things. But to begin with, why would we discuss the idea of authorship or evidences? Anybody? Is it important who wrote this? All right, we talked about verbal communication. I see a lot of the nodding. Verbal communication. Yes, thank you. Thank you. Why is it important, though? Why is it important that we discuss the authorship of this book? Authenticate it. Okay, authenticate it. Helps us to understand about inspiration. You'll see here under external evidences a lot of different references made from 2 Corinthians and other articles, other documents. Why would it be important to go back this far and try to date the book?
Validation.
Give me a little bit more. Give me an explanation. What do you mean validation?
You hear so much, well, that stuff really didn't happen. But if you can date it back to actual events, someone actually seeing it, then that validates or invalidates there. That stuff really didn't happen. It's just a fairy tale.
That's right. If we can date the letter of 2 Corinthians back to the time that it claims to have been written, and this is why we discussed in our last class the dates that it was written. If we can date it back to that time, one, it helps us to authenticate the book. Also, just like we would do with the Gospels, if this weren't a document that was written by Paul the Apostle, or if it was supposedly dated later on, if we can date it back to this time, then you would know that it wasn't authentic, because there would be people who would be refuting it as well. But with no refutation, and we have authentication through these other documents, this is a reason why we would want to go back that far. I say all that to say this. You know, we don't want to find ourselves in a situation where we're believing somebody who stuck a bag over his head and was reading something out of a hat, and you're getting a third party from some mystical alien creature. And that did happen. And so we want to be able to tie this back to Paul the Apostle, who is inspired by the Holy Spirit. Our faith is not built on a house of cards. It is built on evidences, and this is what this helps us do. You'll notice here, I'm not going to go through all of these because they're a mouthful, but you'll notice that the Second Corinthian letter was referenced by Polycarp, in his epistle to the Philippians. You'll notice Diogenes, all these kind of dating back into the first and second century. Let's see. Theonagoras, it even phonetically spells it out, and I still can't do it. Theophilus, Tertullian. And just, we could go on and on. I don't want to expound on it any more than that. We want to date this back so we can show that there is proof, there's evidences that this is dated back to the first century when it was supposed to have been written, and by who it was supposed to, and by that person that we believe it was written by. All right. Who wrote the book?
Paul.
All right. Why do you say that? There we go. It's a simple question. It is a simple question. I just putting you on the spot, Alex. All right. Where was the letter written?
Macedonia.
How do you know that? The Bible tells me so. Go ahead and open your books to 2 Corinthians. I guess we will be studying this letter. We should open our Bibles.
Chapter
right, chapter 2, 12 and 13. Let's look at chapter 2, 12 and 13. Jeff, do you mind reading those for me?
Now when I came to Troas for the gospel of Christ, and when a door was opened for me in the Lord, I had no rest for my spirit, not finding Titus my brother, but taking my leave of him, I went on to Macedonia.
All right, so here he references leaving and going to Macedonia. Let's look also over at 2 Corinthians chapter 7. So, like Jeff has just read, Paul references having left Ephesus and heading to Macedonia. And then chapter 7, verse 5, it says, "For even when we came into Macedonia, our flesh had no rest, for we were afflicted on every side, conflicts without, fears within. But God, who comforts the depressed, comforted us by the coming of Titus, not only by his coming, but also by the comfort with which he was comforted in you, and he reported to us your longing, your mourning, your zeal for me, so that I rejoiced even more." All right, so this will give you an idea as well. Titus met Paul there in Macedonia, but that's not exactly the linchpin. There's a little bit more that we can find to help us pinpoint that this was most likely written in Macedonia.
Chapter 1, 15 and 16. It talks about his intention was to come to them, and that was to pass their way into Macedonia.
Yes. Yes, that is correct.
But he didn't travel that route.
In here, he does mention going, but at that point in time, he did not travel into Macedonia. He was waiting for a response from Titus from the 1 Corinthian letter. 2 Corinthians chapter 9. I think the saying is words are vehicles of communication on which thoughts travel. Am I right? All right. So if we look at, and I'm not an English person, and I am an English person. I speak the English language. If we look at chapter 9, if we pay attention to the tenses that Paul is talking in, starting in verse 3, "But I have sent the brethren in order that our boasting about you may not be made empty in this case, so that as I was saying, you may be prepared. Otherwise, if any Macedonians come with me and find you unprepared, we, not to speak of you, will be put to shame by this confidence. So I thought it necessary to urge the brethren that they would go on ahead to you and arrange beforehand your previously promised bountiful gift, so that the same would be ready as a bountiful gift and not affected by covetousness." So what words in this specific passage would help us to identify that he is most likely or in Macedonia when writing this letter?
If any Macedonians come with me.
Okay, so he does in verse 4 say, "Otherwise, if any Macedonians come," present tense, or, okay, verse 3 also, boasting. Boasting is a present tense word as well. So the idea is he's writing it then. He's writing it in the presence of the Macedonians. Now, again, why is it important to identify where Paul is writing this? Does it matter where he's writing this at? Exactly, exactly. It helps us to tie back into Acts. It does help us look at the recordings in Acts chapter 20 where he talks about his journey, his third missionary journey. It helps us to kind of tie in, you know, and this fits right into that timeline that Luke expressed to us. So it further validates the fact that this letter is accurate. All right.
Keith, it might be helpful to use your map here that you handed out.
Yes, sir. Does anybody need a map, by the way? I do have some.
I'll copy that map. Show us the other chapter 2 that Titus joined the Troas, and he couldn't have written the letter before him because he wrote the letter based upon a report that Titus brought, so he couldn't have written it before them, but their Troas was mapped. then from Troas, you see, goes over to Macedonia. And then he's going to go down to Corinth. So your map shows you that route of travel. And then, as you pointed out in chapter 9, it indicates he's in Macedonia as well.
Now, I'm going to try not to just read from the paperwork that we have. The paperwork does a good, the material does a good job of explaining this. I'm going to try to not just read from it, but if you'll look in here, it says that the only place after Macedonia that he could have written it would have been Athens, but there's no evidence of the church that he had stopped there. There's no evidence of a church there that he had stopped there or that the letter was written from there. So all indications point to the fact that he was in Macedonia when he wrote this letter. All right. When was this letter written?
AD.
All right. Winter, spring, fall, summer.
Summer, fall.
All right. I'm lost in my notes on them.
Why?
I understand. All right. Yes. All right. He wrote the First Corinthian letter in the spring of 57 AD. Why do we think that is, though? Why do we know that is so?
To do with our dating of the first letter.
Okay.
It was right before Pentecost.
The time frame per se, the year, we could be off depending on our anchor points in Acts, but we discussed that we thought it would be 57 AD. The time frame being spring of the first letter would be because he had mentioned that he was going to stay in Ephesus until Pentecost. He may have had to leave earlier because of the riots, but he was planning on coming and traveling into Corinth and spending the winter there. And so based on his travel from Ephesus to Macedonia, he had received he'd written the first letter in the spring, and then by the time that would have given enough time for Titus to travel to and travel back and meet him in the fall of 57 AD in Macedonia. All right. Now to the kind of the crux of the matter. Why was this letter written?
It was a follow-up to the first letter.
Okay, so part of it is a follow-up to the first letter. What did you say, Jeff?
A response to Titus' report about their reception of the first letter.
Yes, yes. Why else was this letter written?
Motivate them to contribute the money they promised to the relief of the brethren.
That's correct. I don't know if y'all heard that, but that is to motivate them to contribute to what they had said they would. Chapters 8 and 9 discuss that. What else? To defend his ministry. Let's look at some verses that give us this indication. Let's look at 2 Corinthians chapter 1. We'll kind of go through some of these verses. Chapter 1 and verse 15. In this confidence, I intended at first to come to you so that you might twice receive a blessing, that is, to pass your way into Macedonia and again from Macedonia to come to you, and by you to be helped on my journey to Judea. When you skip down to verse 23, but I call God as a witness to my soul that to spare you, I did not come again to Corinth. In conjunction with chapter 2, verse 5. But if any has caused sorrow, he has caused sorrow not to me, but in some degree, in order not to say to you, to say too much to all of you. Sufficient for such a one is this punishment, which was inflicted by the majority. So this gives us the idea that he intended to come to them sooner, but because of what he had to write to them, he didn't want to come to them in sorrow, and so he is writing the second letter, to tell them specifically in these passages that the the punishment that they'd inflicted on the person who was committing adultery, fornication, that the punishment had been sufficient. Let's look over at chapter 7. Chapter 7, verse 14. For if anything I have boasted to him about you, I was not put to shame, but as we spoke all things to you in truth, so also our boasting before Titus proved to be in the truth. His affection abounds all the more toward you, as he remembers the obedience of you all, how you receive him with fear and trembling. I rejoice that in everything I have confidence in you. He also writes to commend them for how they received it. So you can see in the first couple of verses we talked about how he is referencing the first letter, and then here he does. He says, I boasted to Titus. I have confidence in you. He is writing this to commend them for the reception of the first letter. This boasting that Paul is doing, is he boasting about all the brethren in the at the church at Corinth?
Well, some of them he slams.
He does. We'll get into this a little bit later, but if you'll notice in this chapter, if you'll notice in chapter 2, he said that it was the punishment inflicted by the majority. That's chapter 2, verse 6. Paul is boasting in those who had done what he had said to do. But there is still a minority who are not abiding by God's word, by what Paul has been teaching them. All right. Now, another reason why Paul wrote this letter, as Todd had said, chapter 8. Look at chapter 8, verse 10. I give my opinion in this matter, for this is to your advantage, who were the first to begin a year ago, not only to do this, but also to desire to do so. But now, finish doing it also, so that just as there was the readiness and desire, so there may also be the completion of it by your ability. This talking about the collection that they were to take up. So he's writing to them. He's told them, you know, I've bragged on you. You were the first a year ago to do this. Let's complete that gift so that they can take it when he leaves. All right, and then moving into chapter 10. Chapter 10, verse 10. Now we talked about Paul defending his ministry. We can see some of that here. For they say his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive and his speech is contemptible. Now, when you read through the 2 Corinthian letter, you will see that he is responding maybe not necessarily to questions or comments that those at the Corinthian church had made, but people who are detractors of his or people who had come in claiming to be apostles or teachers, and they were saying things about Paul. And he does not approve of that language, but he speaks forcefully about it. You know, they say that his letters are weighty and strong, and I mean they talk bad about him while he's not there. Now, regardless of whether his speech was contemptible or his presence was unimpressive, should that deter from what he was teaching? I hope not. I take comfort in that. I don't always get my point across, but hopefully what we do as we are studying the Bible, as somebody is teaching or preaching to us, we don't necessarily take in their appearance or their speech, but what is being taught. Here there were detractors who were trying to take away from Paul and what he was teaching. Flip over to chapter 11. Here again, he's responding to things that have been said to him. Verse 4, for if one comes and preaches another Jesus whom we have not preached, or you receive a different spirit which you have not received, or a different gospel which you have not accepted, you bear this beautifully. There are people who are coming in and preaching things different than what Paul had preached. And so he is defending his ministry and what he has done. down in verse 7, it says, "Or did I commit a sin in humbling myself so that you might be exalted, because I preached the gospel of God to you without charge? I robbed other churches by taking wages from them to serve you. And when I was present with you and was in need, I was not a burden to anyone. For when the brethren came from Macedonia, they fully supplied my needs, and in everything I kept myself from being a burden to you, and will continue to do so. As the truth of Christ is in me, this boasting of mine will not be stopped in the regions of Achaia. Why? Because I do not love you? God knows I do." So again, he's defending himself. You know, they claim that he didn't take money because maybe he didn't it was his lack of faith in his ministry or the lack of love that he had for them, but that's not the case. Here in our material, it says he anticipates coming to Corinth soon. If the letter can be prevent further inroads by the false teachers and accomplish further repentance among those who need it, he will not have to be as severe as he might would upon his arrival. So part of this letter, as he is defending his ministry, he is also refuting what these other people are preaching, trying to get the Corinthian brethren to see that there are false teachers among them, and that what Paul is saying is the inspired word. If we look over at chapter 3, verse 1, something that they said is, "Are we beginning to commend ourselves again, or do we need, as some, letters of condemnation to you or from you?" Did he need a letter of recommendation? He shouldn't. He was an apostle. But some felt that they needed to come with one, and because he didn't have one, he was a lesser man. He wasn't an apostle. But in verse 2, he says, "You are our letter, written in our hearts, known and read by all men, being manifested that you are a letter of Christ, cared for by us, written not with ink, but with the Spirit of the living God, not on tablets of stone, but on tablets of the human hearts." He defends himself against those who are detractors, who are saying that they came with letters of recommendation and he didn't have any. He is trying to get them to see that that these people are weighting them down. They're causing them to turn away from the truth. Let's turn over to chapter 12. Chapter 12, starting in verse 19. "All this time you have been thinking that we are defending ourselves to you. Actually, it is in the sight of God that we have been speaking in Christ, and all for your upbuilding, beloved. For I am afraid that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wished, and may be found by you to be not what you wished. That perhaps there will be strife, jealousy, anger, tempers, disputes, slanders, gossips, arrogance, disturbances. I'm afraid that when I come again, my God may humiliate me before you, and I may mourn over many of those who have sinned in the past and not repented of the impurity, immorality, and sensuality which they have practiced." Verse 2 of chapter 13, "I have previously said, when present the second time, and though now absent, I say in advance to those who have sinned in the past and to all the rest as well, that if I come again, I will not spare anyone." So his hope is that when he comes, that this letter will have pricked their hearts. They will turn away from this false teaching, from these detractors of his, because otherwise he's going to come and have to deal with them. He's not going to spare anyone. He's coming to resolve situations that are going on in this in the Corinthian church. He's not going to pull any punches. He says that here. He's not going to spare anyone. In his letters, when he wrote the First Corinthian letter, he had to address a lot of difficult and heavy things. We see in the Second Corinthian letter that he was very sad. He was sorrowful for having to write those things, but it didn't stop him from doing it. It's what they needed to hear. And his love for him caused the sorrow, but it was also the right thing to do, and that he's glad that they took what he said so well, or at least the majority did. You know, his detractors talked about writing weighty letters, but not when he comes. He's unimpressive in speech and in stature. Paul's trying to do what he thinks is best for them because he doesn't want to come to them. It's not like you want to. We talked about this last time. You don't want to come to see brethren that you haven't seen in a long time and come there and just rain down with an iron fist what's right and what's wrong. He's doing what he thinks what is in their best interest to try to get them back onto the right track so that they may serve God, and then he can come and be joyful and he can boast in them. Any questions? Yes, sir.
There's an interesting thought there you just read in verse 19, chapter 12. But that follows also with what he talked about in the 1 Corinthians letter, chapter 14, that all things are for edification, building up, encouragement. And you could say that Paul's aim for everything he does is what it says right there in 19. All for your upbuilding. All for your upbuilding, and beloved to that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good theme verse for his ministry, for his working with all brethren. Always for upbuilding.
Yes, sir. Another thing that he has to deal with is the superiority that some claim because of their Judaism. If you look over at chapter 11, verse 18, another reasons why Paul, we're talking about why this letter was written. Another reason why is in verse 18 of chapter 11, since many boast according to the flesh, I will boast also, for you being so wise, tolerate the foolish gladly. For you tolerate it if anyone enslaves you, anyone devours you, anyone takes advantage of you, anyone exalts himself, anyone hits you in the face. To my shame, I must say that we have been weak by comparison. Down to verse 22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are the descendants of Abraham? So am I. They come as Judaizing teachers and claim this purity. What about Paul? Is there another verse that we could look at? If that's the way they wanted to address Paul, they wanted to address the purity of their Judaism, what could we look at if Paul wanted to go that route?
He was.
Let's go over to Philippians chapter 3. Philippians chapter 3, let's start in verse 2. Beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the false circumcision. For we are the true circumcision who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Christ and put no confidence in the flesh. Although I myself might have confidence even in the flesh, if anyone has a mind to put confidence in the flesh, I far more. Circumcised on the eighth day of a nation of Israel, the tribe of Benjamin, of a Hebrew of Hebrews, like John mentioned, as to the law of Pharisee, as to zeal, a prosecutor of the church, as to the righteousness which is in the law, found blameless. But whatever things were gained to me, those things I have counted as loss for the sake of Christ Jesus. So did the purity of his Judaism, did it matter? Did it matter to whoever was teaching? Should it have mattered? The matter that teacher was purely a Jew? Obviously not. He said he forsook all this stuff for the sake of Christ. So it shouldn't matter what his heritage was, or one shouldn't be viewed as superior based on their lineage compared to another. They're not under the old law. This new law is open to all mankind. We've addressed they talked about Paul being because of his speech, his appearance. They also claimed to be Paul's equal and called themselves apostles. Let's look over at 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 5. For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. Doesn't that trip with sarcasm? Are they really eminent apostles? No, they're not. Paul, again, is using this letter to defend himself, to defend his ministry, to defend what he is and what he's teaching. right. Now, who carried the letter of, or who do we suppose carried the 2 Corinthian letter?
Titus.
Any reason why? Paperwork says so?
Yeah.
All right, that's right. There you go. We can. You've got notes just like I do. He is supposed to have carried the letter for a couple different reasons. If you look at chapter 7, he's talking about how Titus comforted him by his bringing a letter of response or a report after the 1 Corinthian letter. And then in chapter 8, his desire to go back. So, it is thought that it is probable that he was the messenger to have carried the 2 Corinthian letter. For the sake of time, let's go ahead and move over to our outline. As we get further into our study of 2 Corinthians, it would help us to know that there are three major divisions of this book. Like listed here, it says chapters 1 through 7. This is going to be explaining his motives, defending his office, and commending their obedience. As you read through, he does all three of these things. He wants to commend them for the things that they have taken from his first letter and done. You see that he does defend his ministry as well, and explains why in chapter 1 and 2, why he did change his plans. As you move into chapters 8 and 9, you see a shift. In chapter 8, verse 1, it says, "Now, brethren," kind of shifting his focus to the collection that they were to be taking up so that it could be carried back to Jerusalem. And then moving into chapters 10 through 13, again, you see a shift. And then here is where he discusses or he defends his ministry against those who accuse him of a lot of different things. He vindicates himself. He deals with these accusations being made. And you'll notice as we get into the latter part of 2 Corinthians, the sarcasm, the sarcastic irony that he uses as he's dealing with these people. As I was studying this, it helped me to see how, you know, you don't necessarily recognize it when you use it in day-to-day language and speech, but he does. You know, we use it a lot, and he does that here. Calling them eminent apostles and whatnot. But as you're studying, as we go through the class, let's recognize the divisions and the major divisions in this book. It will help us to study it and to understand it a little bit better. All right, let's move over to our observations page. Something else to notice as we get into studying the letter is that the tone changes from the beginning to the end. Obviously, by the divisions we see in the outline, it's not hard to see that. First off, again, he commends them for their response to the first letter. You move into him talking to them about the collection, but then he goes into, you know, goes from affection of the brethren to rebuking those who believe what these accusers are accusing him of, these detractors. He goes to talking to the majority, to the minority in the groups. In chapter 1, verse 14, he talks about how he's proud. In chapter 7, 5, he talks about the sufficiency of the majority. I'm sorry, that was in chapter 2, verse 6. In chapter 7, he talks about the zeal that they had for him. But then you move into chapter 10, like chapter 10, verse 6. He says he'll punish all disobedience. Chapter 12, it says he didn't want to come and find them as let me read it. Chapter 12, verse 20. "For I am afraid that perhaps when I come, I may find you to be not what I wished, again, he's dealing with a minority here. He's talking, there was a majority who had responded to his first letter, and now he's dealing with the minority. He's trying to, he's rebuking them, trying to get them to turn from their ways so that when he comes, if he has to, he'll have to deal with it when he gets there. But he hopes to find them as he wished as opposed to not to. And then in chapter 13, verse 2, we saw that he says that when he comes, he won't spare anyone. So, you know, you see a shift of tone talking to the various people in the congregation. All right, as we get into the book as well, and I keep saying that, we get into the book next Sunday morning. As we dive deeper into our study, as this is a letter defending Paul's ministry, we can see here things that his opponents had suggested about him that he will be discussing or defending himself against. Chapter 1, that they said that he was fickle and insincere because he changed his plans. As we get into the study, we'll see that there was a purpose for him changing his plans. There was a purpose for him deciding not to directly return back to Corinth, but taking a different route. We've talked about in chapter 3 the fact that he had no letters of condemnation yet. So did he need them? What was the point of those? They call him insane in chapter 5. Was Paul insane? He defends against these things. He addresses these things. Chapter 10, he was a coward for not coming, facing the brethren, that he wrote tough letters but was weak face to face. We will see, and thankful for us, we have all of the letters that Paul wrote plus Acts, which Luke wrote, to see that that is not the way that Paul was. But these are the things that he was having to deal with in this time with these brethren. The fact that they claimed that he had poor speech. Paul may have had poor speech, but should that have affected the message that he was preaching or their reception to it? No. And even if he did have poor speech, look at what great good he did, which should give us comfort in the fact that it's not necessarily the presentation that we give, but the accuracy of the word as we go on about our daily lives teaching people. Talks about maybe him being inferior to them because he didn't take support. You know, he defends against that as well. Or that maybe he didn't love the Corinthian brethren. As you read this book, you know that that's not true. As you read this letter, you know that that's not true. Or that he treated them badly. Or that he was self-serving. He defends against us all these things. He tries to vindicate himself, not only himself, but his apostleship. And as you read this letter, you'll see kind of a different side, or a side that you don't necessarily see in other letters. You'll see a different side of Paul. You'll get an insight into his heart, the love that he had for these brethren, and the love that he must have had for the works that the people that he did as he went to these different congregations and he taught. Paul loved these brethren. He had an affection for these brethren, and he boasted about them. And so writing this book, letter, as he wrote this letter, you can see that love, that he really was sorrowful, and that he pours his heart out to these people because he loves them. Again, I kind of see it in the parent-child relationship. You love them, so you discipline them. You love them, so you talk to them. You try to steer them onto the right path. Ultimately, he can't do it for them, but you see an insight to his heart in this letter. So, what is the value of this book, this letter? I'm going to get that right. I will. What is the value of this letter? And I've done enough talking, y'all tell me. You can pick any of the five.
Yeah, it really gives insight that so many things have not changed. I mean, today you have a lot of ministers that actually water down the gospel. You know, they give the health, wealth, prosperity gospel. But Paul did immense words. He just preached the pure gospel.
That's definitely practical application for the study, definitely. What about the value of what Paul's writing to them?
If he can defend his ministry here, it cements and establishes most of the New Testament. So there's great value in that, seeing that he can fend off the criticisms that they levy, and also seeing the criticisms that they didn't make. things that they couldn't challenge, like his miracles?
If any of the things that they attacked him with were to stick, I mean, wouldn't it cause us to doubt or shake our faith? He is the author of 13 different letters in the book that we hold in front of us. You know, these people are addressing things in that time, in his time. They are addressing many different weaknesses or problems or inferiorities that he has. And Paul gives that defense. So if he can do that in that time when people were doing it, should we have confidence that this is Paul the Apostle, that if his detractors couldn't take away from him then, that we really can't take away from him now? It helps solidify our faith in a lot of different senses, seeing as he wrote a lot of the New Testament.
Well, you wrote here he was vindicated in the face of bitter, shrewd, powerful, and current enemies. That's pretty much what Christians face today. Nothing's really changed.
You know, he also, it helps us to understand the appreciation of apostolic authority. The fact that Paul was an apostle, that the things he taught, how did he confirm the things that he taught were inspired? Miracles. Okay, and Paul was an apostle. There are detractors in this letter who talk that like he wasn't an apostle or they were apostles, but Paul was able to prove that through the miracles that he worked to confirm what he was teaching. It also, Alex has talked about practical applications. We can see the problems that the New Testament churches had and know that they're similar to the problems we have now. All right, and so there is practical application in this book. Paul and the things that he is addressing in this book can pertain to the things that we're dealing with now. Not only what they're dealing with, but how he dealt with them as individuals, what we can do as elders, what they can do in dealing with situations. This is definitely, when he's defending his ministry, difficult things. And so it helps us to understand how we can deal with those things. The value of discipline. You know, he talked in the first letter about withdrawing from the one who was committing fornication, and then what did that do? They didn't want it to be. He had repented, and so he wanted to make sure that it wasn't too much, and so he told them that the punishment was sufficient, and to bring him back into the fold, and understanding that something along those lines, the discipline that the individuals may impose on others because of their sin is effective and done out of love, and it can bring some back. It can prick their hearts. And then lessons on the law, giving, purity. There are a lot of other things in this book as we go through that we will see and understand. And then, here, when you have time, look at the relationship between our 1 Corinthian and 2 Corinthian letter. I skipped over There are people who suppose that there may have been a letter in between here, but you can see the direct correlation, the direct connection between the 1 Corinthian letter, what Paul wrote, and then the 2 Corinthian letter, and the things that he says, these specifically being examples. So, I think that's our time for the class this period. So, pick up your material for Sunday and next Wednesday in the foyer before you leave.